What exactly is money? In its most basic form, it's a measurement of wealth and a commodity accepted by general consent as a medium of exchange for goods and services. Every society uses some version of it. But recently, the emergence of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have had a huge impact on what money can do. I'm Christy Eye, and you're watching The Cost of Everything. Cryptocurrencies have always been a controversial topic, with many skeptics calling it a bubble and an equivalent to tulip mania. Regulators and countries have also tried to stomp out Bitcoin, calling it a threat to the financial system, saying that the cost of Bitcoin to the financial markets is just too high. But Bitcoin, or any other cryptocurrency, is that really a threat to the financial system? Absolutely. Bitcoin offers people financial freedom to live outside the banks and controls built by the regulators to restrict the movement of capital. It is a threat to the current regime, as crypto is a technology that empowers the people. Meanwhile, the epic collapse of FTX is still causing ripple effects to other crypto companies. FTX disintegrated practically overnight after it was unable to meet a run on deposits that left the company with an $8 billion hole in its accounts. The founder of FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, founded what he claimed were two separate companies, a hedge fund called Alameda Research and a crypto exchange platform called FTX. FTX's native currency was a coin called FTT, which was printed and used as collateral for Alameda to take out loans. At one point, FTT traded as high as $80, so it took out a huge amount of loans at the time. And this is extremely dangerous because if the price of FTT fell below a certain level, it would leave Alameda unable to pay back its lenders. Now, in early November, a report showed that two-fifths of Alameda's $14 billion balance sheet was held in FTT, sparking panic among FTX's customers. CZ, the CEO of Binance, immediately dumped 23 million FTT tokens, sending the price into freefall. As FTX was unraveling, it was further revealed that SBF had created a secret backdoor in FTX that allowed him to move depositors' money off the exchange to Alameda without alerting customers. So the lesson of the story once again is, not your keys, not your wallet. No matter how secure or safe a centralized exchange might look like from the outside, if ever there's fraud, a hack, a liquidity issue, or another black swan event, your funds will not be safe if you do not own your own keys. Now, many customers are now learning this lesson the hard way with the collapse of FTX, as FTX held billions of dollars in assets and deposits for the customers and traders. Multiple crypto trading firms and hedge funds who utilized FTX are now illiquid, such as Aros Global, Galeos Capital, and Nuho Technology. They have all failed because of its massive exposure to FTX. Genesis Trading also said that it has $175 million in locked funds in its FTX trading account. Now, the latest casualty is BlockFi, a crypto lender platform, as it also files for bankruptcy, citing massive exposure to FTX. Now, for more on the epic collapse, we have joining us Chris Rice, host of Rice TVX. So, Chris, what was the main cause of the FTX failure? How did it all start? And did CZ plan all of this to happen after SBF called him out?
That's a great question. And I don't think that CZ was the one that really pushed this thing to escalate. I think CZ was the straw that broke the camel's back. It looked like there was a lot of foul play going on for quite some time within FTX and Alameda both. And it looks like there's a lot of corruption surrounding it. Now, I don't have any factual evidence of proof of this, but there seems to be some collusion with the SEC, Gary Gensler. It seemed as if Gensler was helping with FTX with legal loopholes. It's really interesting if you look at charts that when Gary Gensler took his position as SEC chair, You could see that the FTT token had been going up that entire time. From that moment, it's complete green candles, which is very interesting when you think about that. Then you also have all the things on the back end. I think his name is Dan Friedberg, is one of the attorneys on counsel at either Alameda or FTX, and he has been involved in some previous poker scandals. And then there's some question about SBF's parents, but ultimately it looks like SBF was utilizing FTX and Alameda as his own personal bank account. There should have been separation of funds based off of the terms and conditions, and there were not any sort of separation of funds. So everybody's funds were at the same risk. And if you go through their terms and conditions, you'll see that they have different risks for people that are leverage trading, that are doing lending or borrowing, versus somebody who's just using the platform just to trade, who didn't opt in for any of those other services. So unfortunately, their terms and conditions seem to have been a lie from the very beginning. And it seems to be a lot of accountability. And I've seen many interviews with Sam Bankman-Fried over the past few weeks since everything's occurred. And it seems like more and more he's incriminating himself. And one thing that I will add is that I'm really good friends with Ben Armstrong from BitBoy Crypto. I go on his channel weekly for Around the Blockchain. And he's been calling out Sam Bankman-Fried for quite some time before the information went public. This thing goes a lot deeper than what so far has been released publicly.
And what is the fallout from FTX? How many people are now suffering as collateral damage?
A lot. There's a lot of people that have lost a lot of money. I mean, there's even some people that were spokespeople for FTX that had a lot of money locked up on the exchange that lost. So, and right now I'm not sure what kind of ramification, what kind of remedy is going to be given to the customers at this time, because we don't know what kind of funds are currently available.
And now, does this set the crypto industry back a few years, or was this actually a necessary purge to show the dangers of a centralized platform?
It's, I would kind of say yes to both. I unfortunately don't want this to set crypto back, but and really what I try to explain to individuals is this has nothing to do with cryptocurrency or blockchain technology. This is simply human greed. And the medium that they were able to defraud people happened to be a cryptocurrency exchange and investment company. So when it really comes down to it, if we can get enough people speaking out publicly, saying exactly what I just said, that this isn't a problem with the technologies, this is a problem with human beings. And unfortunately, this is something that we've been dealing with for quite some time, you know, throughout our history of existence. So when it comes down to the fallout from this, I mean, we're not sure what kind of companies have had exposure ultimately. And unless somebody is in dire danger, I don't see them right now coming out publicly and letting people know what's going on with their company until it's actually a problem. I still feel there may be some fallout, but it may not be completely from straight FTX. Again, I'm just not sure what companies had exposure, but the real sad thing that we are seeing is companies that are still existing are looking at moving outside of the United States and stop allowing for their services for United States citizens due to uncertainty and regulation. So we definitely need to be pushing for positive regulation in the United States. We need to do the best that we can to be educating politicians about what cryptocurrency and blockchain technologies are about, and what the problems are with centralization versus decentralization, because this would also be another way to point the fault at centralization. Had this been a decentralized project, it wouldn't have been a situation where one individual or a group of individuals wouldn't have been able to do this.
BlockFi is now declaring bankruptcy, citing the FTX contagion as the main reason. But is that entirely true, or was it also engaged in its own risky lending business?
I haven't had a chance to look at any sort of the paperwork and see any of the numbers, but I would think that it would probably be a combination of both. Now, from what I am understanding, though, it looks as if FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, and everybody were involved with a lot of different market manipulation. And I'm starting to hear through the grapevine that Celsius's fallout mainly could have been due to the FTX issue. FTX on the back end doing things to drive Celsius out of the industry. But there may have been some things that weren't being done on the best end by Celsius either. So I would put that as a combination as well. So I think people were over leveraging their positions. I think people thought, you know, they were playing a game for so much time and kept continuing to win. And I feel like they thought that that wasn't going to stop, you know, and unfortunately we are in a bear market, regardless of if you own an exchange and you're rehypothecating coins or not, you know, we're in a bear market. The trading activity has gone down, has decreased, you know, immensely. And again, we're not really sure about the companies like still where the fallout and contagion is going to end. It appears that Genesis, which is an institutional lender, is having some issues. And some of it is, or the majority of it seems to be related to FTX. And they also have a partnership, a Gemini exchange, that deals with the lending, which has to do with rewards for credit cards, staking, and things like that. That was a partnership between Genesis and Gemini. And now Genesis is having issues. Genesis is owned by Digital Currency Group. And the Digital Currency Group owns a lot in crypto. They're almost kind of a mafia boss in crypto. And they're trying to do some private equity fundraising, from what I understand. They also own Grayscale. So it is possible that we could see the contagion from Genesis bleed into Grayscale. We could see Grayscale become insolvent. And that would be really interesting, being that Grayscale owns 3% of the supply of Bitcoin. They would be forced to liquidate. Now, in that situation, that would be what I would think would be the last of what we're going to see for that next drop. Because a lot of people are anticipating that we are going to go lower into cryptocurrency markets. And I believe Grayscale becoming insolvent would be the catalyst for that.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Chris. Now, when we come back, what is the cost of producing cryptos? Is it environmentally friendly? We'll have more after the break.
Forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence as own existence.
In recent days, Bitcoin has received a lot of criticism for its energy consumption. But is this really the whole story, and is it really that bad? So let's put some things into perspective, actually, with some real numbers. A recent peer-reviewed white paper found that Bitcoin consumes 113 terawatt hours per year, while the traditional banking industry consumed 263 terawatt hours per year. So that's actually less than half of that of banking. Now let's compare to that of the gold industry. Gold consumes around 240 terawatt hours per year. Now, how is this possible? There's no denying that Bitcoin consumes a substantial amount of energy, but it is actually more efficient than banking, as it's not just a store of value, it is also a medium of exchange and the settlement layer. Moreover, Bitcoin is actually driving the renewable energy movement. This is simply because energy is the biggest and most expensive input. So naturally, miners are motivated to drive that cost down. Other industries like manufacturing are also very energy intensive, but they have less of an incentive because other costs like metals, lumber, steel, labor, etc., they're bigger costs that they're more focused on. So for more, we have Christy Harkins, CoinDesk's Managing Editor of Technology. So Christy, many critics still argue that miners are the ideal customer for fossil fuels rather than renewables, since these are both cheap and a consistent source of power. So what is the energy mix of these miners?
There are a couple of questions in there to unpack. The first one, I'm not sure where the argument comes from about being ideal customers for fossil fuels instead of renewables. Bitcoin mining is a market-driven industry, like pretty much anything else. Miners look for a number of factors when they're setting up their mining farms. They're looking for, first off, the most efficient, cost-effective, and reliable source of energy, a stable regulatory environment to set up operations in, and a stable infrastructure and workable relationship with the area where they plan to set up. On top of that, environmental impact is becoming more and more of a consideration for Bitcoin miners. They care about this kind of stuff. Last year, a group of miners got together, spearheaded by Bitcoiners like Michael Saylor, to work together on energy consumption accountability. And so the resulting Bitcoin Mining Council has actually produced some pretty good numbers. By the end of Q2, they say its members, representing over 50% of global hash rate, that's the amount of hash rate power that goes into computing Bitcoin. All of those miners together, 50% of the ones that we have in the world, are using electricity with a 66.8% sustainable power mix. It estimates that the Global Mining Council estimates that the global industry as a whole is using a sustainable mix of around 59.5%, which is a year-over-year increase of 6%. So the goal for this coalition is ultimately carbon neutrality, which is a pretty ambitious goal. There aren't a lot of other major global industries that have been pushing for this sort of reduction. And to that end, because as I say, they look for efficiency, there's a huge push toward innovation within the Bitcoin mining industry. Efficiency itself is paramount. So high performance rigs that consume less energy in the first place are always being developed. Novel ways of capturing otherwise inaccessible renewable energy or wasted energy are being developed. And they're pioneers, really, in many ways. Bitcoin miners are pioneering this kind of energy transformation. And why? Because it's good for Bitcoin miners' bottom line. It all comes down to the money. No one wants to be paying for any more energy than they have to. So to that point, the Bitcoin Mining Council, in that same report, estimated that mining technology efficiency has grown by 46% over the past year, which suggests that as the network grows, it's going to become even more efficient over time. We're just going to see that keep happening.
And how are miners utilizing flared gas mitigation? Is this an efficient use of energy that would otherwise be wasted?
Yeah, so first of all, you have to understand what flared gas is. So when natural gas, what happens is during mining processes, and we're talking about like oil refining. So when natural gas is brought to the surface, but it can't be easily used or diverted, you know, taken somewhere where it can be used, then the oil companies just burn it. That's called flaring. So you just, and that's where you get those big flames coming up from oil wells. So flaring mainly happens when gas is produced as a byproduct of oil extractions. And if there's no infrastructure to put this gas to productive use, then you get that flaring and that burning, and all of that is just released into the atmosphere. So there are several ways that other industries, including Bitcoin, are capturing and using this otherwise wasted flared gas. In an article for Markets Insider, one Bitcoin mining company, Crusoe Energy, said that its system for capturing and using flare gas from oil patches slash CO2 equivalent emissions from gas flaring by up to 63%, and that each one has the equivalent effect of taking around 1,700 cars off the road. So that's a pretty good thing to be doing. Is it as good as, say, the oil refinery not flaring the gas in the first place? Yes, it is. Is it better than not having an oil refinery at all and just being green all around? Well, no, but it's there and it's otherwise going to be wasted. So let's be resourceful. Let's use it. And that's what's happening with flared gas. And kind of like, you know, the oil, the cooking oil that would otherwise go into the lake, it's being used in some way and creating a positive effect. And creating a positive effect, not just for the miners, but sometimes even for the gas company or the oil company. So it's worth their while for them to work with Bitcoin miners in order to repurpose this flared gas.
And what other industries are guilty of high energy consumption? Are they making more or less of an effort to use renewable energy, as is the case with Bitcoin?
Well, there are two things here. First off, I don't know that whataboutism is going to be particularly helpful, but also we all need to sort of just pause and acknowledge the fact that everything that we want costs energy. And what we have to do is weigh the pros and cons of that thing that we want and decide what it is we're willing to pay for it. Think about it in terms of its economic price, its environmental price, its ethical or ideological price, and whatever other metric is important for us to consider. So Bitcoin uses a lot of energy, and that's by design. As I explained, its energy is the price that miners pay to participate in the system that in turn secures a transparent, uncensorable, decentralized hard currency that's backed by code, accessible to anywhere in the world, and independent of any nation state. And we have to remember that there are a lot of other countries besides the US that, you know, really can benefit from having that kind of accessibility to a financial system. Like any other currency, Bitcoin's value is derived from its users' perception of what it's worth. But unlike any other currency, its supply cannot be randomly inflated by a government body. And we're seeing a lot of that happening around the world over the last couple of years. And by having to commit energy to the process, miners are prevented from merely spamming the system or otherwise attacking it. So for anyone who values this particular form of money, using energy to secure it is extremely worthwhile. Bitcoiners would argue that it is more valuable in the long term than, say, precious metals or stones, the mining of which are unbelievably harmful to the environment. Have you seen an open pit? That kind of mining practice is very, very destructive. So, you know, but we don't really think about that too much. Let's consider, if you do want to point to another industry, let's consider, say, the fashion industry, especially fast fashion. Think about the vast amounts of resources from production to distribution to delivery, especially if you're ordering, say, one pair of socks on Amazon and getting that delivered to your door. That's a lot of energy, not to mention the tonnage of landfill that it generates after those socks wear out in a year. So I haven't really heard of any sort of fashion coalition pledging that it will make the fashion industry carbon neutral anytime soon, but we're not seeing investors or other groups clutching their pearls over that either. So personally, I'm more concerned about securing my money than I am about getting cheap socks. So, you know, you have to really just weigh what are we wanting and what is it going to cost? And this is one of the costs that, you know, some people think is absolutely worthwhile.
Thank you so much for coming on. Christy Harkins, CoinDesk's Managing Editor of Technology. So for the cost of cryptocurrency, who will win and lead the next big crypto boom? I believe that gaming is going to be the next big sector for the community. With GameFi and the Metaverse projects, they have begun to utilize NFTs and tokens in ways other than pure speculation. So I believe that is going to be the next big step in this space as it matures. These games have apparently been unaffected by Bitcoin's decline, and projects like Splinterlands have held 350,000 daily unique active wallets since May. I'm Christy Yai. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll see you back here next time on The Cost of Everything.